I'm Sarah Schwartz-Sachs, and this is the Jamaica Plain Forum podcast, with community conversations on the great issues of the day. Visit us online at www.jamaicaplainforum.org to find out about upcoming events. And subscribe to our podcast to take us with you everywhere you go. The Jamaica Plain Forum is a program of the First Church in Jamaica Plain Unitarian Universalist and the Institute for Policy Studies. Podcast recorded and produced by David Goodman of the Independent Broadcast Information Service, ibisradio.org. Technical support for this podcast comes from the folks at quilted.org.
So you'll see next season as we do films, they'll be on much better equipment. We like to think of the Jamaica Plain Forum as a commons. We're a place where we come together. We're owned by the community. We are. The programming comes from people who approach us and say, "We'd like to partner to do an event. Would you? We know somebody who's a speaker, so please let us know your thoughts on us." Our speaker tonight, Bill McKibben, is really one of our high points of our first year. And I want to thank our many co-sponsors, including the Boston Climate Action Network, the J.P. Greenhouse, the Massachusetts Climate Action Network, the Mass Energy Consumers Alliance, which is offsetting this event, Grassroots International, Institute for Policy Studies, and TELUS Institute. So thanks to all those co-sponsors. Also thanks to Sarah Schwartz-Sachs, who is our wonderful coordinator, wherever she is. Where are you, Sarah? She's really the organizer and implementer. Please respect this wonderful over 150-year-old sacred space here. We ask that you not eat or drink things other than water, but we certainly understand if you're drinking water out there. Please turn off your cell phones and other noisemakers. Bathrooms are through this door here. There's bathrooms on the first level. There's an accessible bathroom as you kind of head out towards the Elliott Street door, and there's two other bathrooms on the second floor. If you have a restless child with you and you'd like to still listen to the talk but not distract your neighbors, we actually have a room where you can sit, your child can play with blocks, and you can listen to the talk. Restless adults can also go there if need be. I'm going to ask Vicky Bach to introduce our speaker tonight, but I want to let you know about two other events this month that we're going to do. And if you picked up the flyer, you'll see that on the back we mention seven members of our community, building trade workers, have spent quite a bit of time in the Ninth Ward in New Orleans helping rebuild parts of that neighborhood after Hurricane Katrina. A member of our church, Rick Yoder, electrician, and several other people from our community have gone down. And we have asked them to do a report back. A neighbor-to-neighbor report back on Friday, the 27th at the end of this month, and they're putting together a multimedia slideshow and some of their reflections on what it's been like. So we hope that you'll come out and hear from Rick Yoder and the JP Building Trades workers. Also, that same weekend, Saturday night, we have an event called Wake Up the Politics, and the hope of this event is that it be kind of a pep rally to get us into the summer and into the fall. And what is it that we as citizens need to do to strengthen our democracy? We know that there's going to be this national election, but what about us? What are we going to do? And we have a couple of speakers, the Reverend William McNeary, who I can attest is one of the greatest inspirational orators about the need for social change that you'll ever hear, will be speaking here, along with Representative Patrick Kennedy. And he's committed to come, even though his dad has been struggling with his health. He said, "I want to come here to Jamaica Plain and be part of this program." And Gloria Bell Mota, who is a terrific organizer from East Boston and an inspirational community leader. So on Saturday, June 28th, come back for a Wake Up the Politics program. All those events are free and at 7 o'clock here at First Church. And now to introduce our special guest this evening, Vicky Bach, who's a neighborhood activist. She was one of the coordinators of the Climate Conversation Cafe we had here in April, and she's active with the Boston Climate Action Network. Please welcome Vicky Bach.
Well, what a perfect hot evening to talk about global warming. Hope everyone can stay cool. So my name is Vicky Buck, and I'm with the Boston Climate Action Network as a volunteer, one of the sponsors of tonight's event. Are these working properly? There we go. I don't want to be too soft. I'm really pleased to be here tonight to offer some words of welcome and introduction for Bill McKibben. First, just quickly, Boston Climate Action Network organizes a variety of local event warming cafe right here in this church a couple of months ago. We have worked with, I think, about 40 or 50 now families in Dorchester and Jamaica Plain on cutting their carbon footprint by an average of 30%. And that's an ongoing project, and if anyone would like to find out more about it, come find me after the talk. We also advocate for legislative change. We do a number of things. But meanwhile, what an honor and a treat it is to have Bill McKibben here tonight with us as the second act of his Jamaica Plain doubleheader here on this hot day. Bill, as many of you know, is an acclaimed author, an environmentalist, an educator, and currently scholar in residence at Middlebury College in Vermont. His first book, The End of Nature, written almost 20 years ago in 1989, was the very first book written for a general audience about climate change, and that really helped to launch the national conversation we've been having ever since, and hopefully more energetically lately. But while Bill is perhaps best known for his climate change work, his writings, in fact, span an incredibly wide range as I started Googling and realizing the many, many topics he's written on. Everything from family and population issues, genetic engineering, the media, economic policy, the value of close-knit local communities where neighbors know and rely on their neighbors. He even wrote a book called Long Distance, A Year of Living Strenuously, about a year he spent training at an elite level as a cross-country skier. And that's the one I'm dying to read next. For so many of us, Bill's is such an important and trusted voice, unfailingly articulate, thought-provoking, wise, and personal, and humorous, helping us to sort out what it means to be alive right now here in the United States in the early part of the 21st century. Over the past few years, as the bad news has mounted about the toll that global warming is taking on the planet, Bill has increasingly turned his energies towards community organizing and action. In 2006, he organized a march across the state of Vermont, urging legislative action on climate change, saying famously that, quote, "The only part of the environmental movement that's been missing over the past 20 years is the movement." Then in 2007, he launched the Step It Up campaign, urging Congress to take steps to cut carbon emissions 80% by 2050, which resulted in 1,400 separate demonstrations in all 50 states on Earth Day. And I'm proud to say that my family and I staged a very small demonstration in the U.S. Virgin Islands that day. So I will leave it to Bill to tell us more about his current effort, 350.org. You can see his shirt. He's prepared to talk on that, I know, which lays out the need for even more dramatic changes as we become increasingly aware that we have already overshot the sustainable amount of carbon dioxide that the planet can safely hold. So many of those of us in this room are already working hard to make Jamaica Plain and other local neighborhoods the kinds of healthy and resilient communities that Bill describes in his recent books, whether it's through the JP Forum, local CSAs, community development corporations, neighborhood sports leagues, whatever it is that we're all working on. But there's still so much more to do. We are all here tonight hungry for the kind of leadership that Bill provides, and we're so grateful to him for making the time to be with us here tonight. So please give Bill McKibben a warm Jamaica Plain style welcome.
All set. Am I audible out there? And also, forgive me, I realize I'm not really dressed quite appropriately for this august space. It was one of those days where I had to choose because I gave a talk this afternoon at the Bikes Not Bombs big rally out in front of the Stony Brook D station there at that park. And it was actually one of the more curious talks I've ever given. Because there was a big space about this big in front in the direct beating sun with no one in it, and then hundreds of people sort of skulking in the shade all around it. And the stage itself was painted dark black, and it was radiating heat at us, so it's very nice to be in here, and it's very nice to be in this amazing church building. Now, you know, I'm a Methodist Sunday school teacher, and Sunday school teachers spend most of their time down in the basement, you know, drawing, coloring with the, you know, little ones and things. So, I think we suffer from a kind of pulpit envy, you know. So I may be here a little while tonight, you know, enjoying this. I should have gone up there, you know, 10 feet above contradiction, but this is good enough. I've really been looking forward to this. I do a lot of speaking, but this is a special place. This is an important community and one that's set the tone for a lot of neighborhoods and communities around New England and really around the country. And I was thinking a lot about the kind of things I wanted to talk about tonight. It's such an interesting moment that we find ourselves in. I think the last couple of months have been one of the most interesting moments of my life. I think, though we haven't quite realized it completely yet, that we're just in the process, in these few months, of going through one of those real watersheds in our history as a country, as a culture, as an economy. Think about the things that have happened in the last couple of months. We've just found out last month that last year, for the first time since Americans began driving, they drove less in the course of a year than they had the year before. In fact, in May, Americans drove 6% less than they did May a year ago. That's a large change. In fact, on Monday, General Motors announced that the Hummer factory was shutting down for good. You know, the airlines in the last couple of weeks, Northwest Air announced that it was cutting its cargo flights dramatically. United announced that a route they'd fought hard to get from Philadelphia to Beijing, they no longer wanted to open. The same with U.S. Air, a route from San Francisco to Guangzhou. In fact, all the airlines are busy trying to take planes out of the sky, to shed seats, to reduce dramatically the amount that they're flying. Think about, in the last few months, what we've learned about housing in this country. After at least a 50-year period, when the American dream could be easily summarized as building bigger houses farther apart from each other, something that we've basically devoted most of our economic might to in the post-war years, all of that's suddenly changed. I mean, the value of homes, of course, is plummeting, but the one set of homes that really aren't plummeting much in value are those in places like this, in good, livable communities, in the first ring of suburbs that are still have some kind of walkable core, and those places that are near enough transit to be connected to something. There was a study just released done in Texas, of all places, showing that homes lost value, $4,700 in value for every minute extra commute that it took to get to the center city. All of a sudden, those things are changing and changing very fast. We're seeing nothing less, I think, than a rejiggering of the American dream in profound ways. I don't think that this is just a blip. I mean, it's possible that oil prices have super spiked because of speculation and they may come down a little bit, but the long-term trend is enormously clear. We're running out of the stuff upon which our economy has been built for 200 years, and hence our economy and our lives are going to look very different. To me, it's sort of most akin to the moment those of you who are students of American history will remember the moment in 1893 when the eminent historian Frederick Jackson Turner announced that his statistical sort of data showed that the American frontier had closed, that there was no longer a kind of open frontier, that there were no counties left in America without people in, no areas like that without people in them, that the density everywhere in the country had reached such that it was no longer possible to really speak of an American frontier. And that was an enormous change for the American psyche and the idea? Well, I think that the frontier of assumed easy, endless mobility is closing, and closing fast. I think probably that the frontier of endless growth, endless kind of mindless growth in personal consumption is probably closing and closing fast, and that we're entering a very new world very quickly. Forget about the idea that the world is flat, you know, propounded by Mr. Friedman in the New York Times so often in the last few years. Right now, and I think for the foreseeable future, wherever you are, the world, the rest of the world is uphill from where you are. You know? And I think that that's new, and I think that hill will get probably steeper over time. And the question that I want to lay before you tonight is whether or not that's something we should mourn or something that we should take as cause for at least a sort of muted celebration. And I'm going to argue, I think, the latter, that it really isn't bad news what's happening now, that it's just the opposite, that the release of at least a little bit of the constant upward pressure on our economy, on our consumption patterns, on the ways that we use the world, is in fact both necessary and salutary. And I guess I'll start with necessary first. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on it. In fact, I'm going to try to spend not that much time on anything because I'm well aware that 9 o'clock is an important hour in New England tonight, and I wish not to delay any of you from the first quarter. But the environmental reasons why it's essential that sooner or later we hit this plateau or decline in the ways in which we use the world are at some level kind of obvious, you know. On a finite world, the prospect of infinite expansion is impossible, and that's where we are. The Chinese, at the rate that their economy has been growing in the last few years, will be as rich as we are on average by about 2035 or something like that. If they consumed like Americans, well, I mean, the current 800 million cars on this planet would be joined by 1.1 billion cars in China alone. Okay? There's not enough steel for that. There's not enough rubber for that. There's clearly not enough gasoline, and there's definitely not enough atmosphere, you know, for that to happen. If the Chinese ate the same diet that we ate, rich in grain-fed beef, the Chinese alone would consume about 2/3 of the world's grain harvest. Okay? This kind of numbers are just completely impossible. Our grain harvest as a world has plateaued over the last 15 years total, and it clearly isn't going to be going up much as it tries to deal with the changes in weather and things that we see. And in fact, it's that second factor, those changes in the weather, that make it extremely good news that we can see at some point now in the near future the leveling off and hopefully the decline in the demands that we place on the world around us. As Vicky said, I wrote the first book about climate change 20 years ago, The End of Nature. At the time, it was a hypothesis, this idea that we were burning enough gas and oil and coal and hence putting enough carbon in the atmosphere to really change the temperature, seemed on the one hand scientifically strong. We knew a lot about the structure of CO2 and its heat-trapping capacities, but it also seemed emotionally counterintuitive that we had grown large enough to be really altering the most basic forces on the planet around us, the climate. And in those 20 years, you know, I've watched with sadness a certain amount of vindication, I suppose, but great sadness as that hypothesis has turned into a strong scientific consensus. And then in recent years, and I will spend a minute describing this, into what amounts to almost a kind of panic in the scientific community. The last couple of years, the last 18 months, have been quite extraordinary for what they've taught us about this experiment that we have undertaken on the surface of the Earth. which seems now to be spinning out of control much more quickly and on a much larger scale than we would have guessed even a few years ago. Last summer, to give the most vivid example, you will remember the rapid melt of sea ice across the Arctic. Ice in the Arctic melts every summer, and it's been melting at an ever greater rate since we really started heating the planet in about 1970. The old record set in September of 2005, it's always at the end of September when the Arctic ice reaches its minimum before the long winter night descends and it starts to refreeze, the old record was about 25% below the norm from pre-1970. So quite noticeable if you looked at it from a satellite photograph, very clear. But last summer, things just went crazy. We broke the old record in about August 16th, and then we were losing an area of ice the size of California every week for the next 6 weeks. And by the time we were done, we'd broken the old record by another 25%. The Northwest Passage, which has been closed not for all of human history, but for much longer than that, was wide open for about 4 weeks last summer. The Northeast Passage was more or less open. Quite unbelievable. Combined with similar data from several other physical systems, maybe most notably what's happening in the boreal tundra and permafrost regions, as they begin to melt and methane, another potent greenhouse gas, begins to escape from beneath, and the volume is really quite staggering. There have been places the last few winters in Siberia where even at the depth of the Siberian winter in the coldest places on Earth, lakes and ponds and marshes have been kept open, not frozen, because there's so much methane bubbling out all the time. It's like a fountain just keeping them open. These new data sets got many scientists, to take another look at where we were in the data. People I knew who had been concerned and sober were all of a sudden quite shocked and shaken. And maybe the best example of this, or the sort of foremost climatologist that we have, James Hansen of NASA, the man who 20 years ago this June stood up in Congress and said, there's this thing called global warming and you better pay attention to it, sort of launching this era. This year, 20 years later, Hansen published a paper with a number of co-authors in which he put a number to this fear, this number 350 that I'm wearing across my chest for reasons that I'll kind of explain a little bit later. What he said was that we now know enough from paleoclimatic data and from real-world reaction to climate change to be able to say that 350 parts per million CO2 represents the maximum safe amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. That we've got to get below that and maybe considerably below it to have a chance. This is a very tough number because we're already past it. Okay? The current atmospheric concentration of CO2 in the atmosphere is about 385 parts per million, up from 275 before the Industrial Revolution, and growing at about 2 parts per million per year. In other words, Hansen's declaration was, this is not a future problem, this is not something that we have to sort of start taking out an insurance policy against, this is not something that we need to begin planning. This is the crisis that we're in. We're already in the rapids. The waterfall can be seen on the horizon. It is just like going to the doctor, and the doctor says, sorry, your cholesterol is too high. You're now in that zone where your chance of having a stroke or a heart attack is greatly elevated, and until you change your lifestyle enough to get back down out of that zone, that risk is going to be very strong. For the planet, the risk is not stroke or heart attack. The risk, we've already seen one of these tipping points pass, the melt of Arctic sea ice. That's bad enough. It creates its own feedback effects. You lose that white reflective shield across the north that reflects 80% of the sun's rays back out to space, and you replace it with blue water that absorbs 80% of that incoming radiation. So that's bad enough. But there are another 4 or 5 of these major tipping points coming at us that we seem to be approaching with great rapidity. Melt of alpine glaciers, particularly in the tropics and subtropics, that provide the drinking water for hundreds and hundreds of millions of people, and without which life in many places, it's very hard to imagine how it continues. major shifts of monsoonal rain patterns across particularly the subcontinent of Asia that are in Africa as well, that are, you know, underwrite the nutrition of hundreds of millions, if not billions of people. Maybe most profoundly unsettling, the quite real probability now of very rapid sea level rise as the great ice sheets above the West Antarctic and Greenland begin to disintegrate. We used to think that would take a long time. A mile and a half thick sheet of ice, how do you go about melting it? There's a lot of inertia there. We don't think so any longer. It's beginning to look like those systems are far more dynamic and fractured than we understood. As you raise the temperature and start to melt the layer or the top few feet of snow, it isn't politely evaporating off into the atmosphere. It's finding cracks and fissures, making its way down to the base of those ice sheets, beginning to grease the skids for their slide into the ocean. There's a lot of water in those ice sheets. If Greenland alone slides into the sea, it raises the level of the ocean upwards of 20 feet. You know, those of you with Google Earth loaded on your computer, go plug in a 20-foot sea level rise and see, among other things, what Greater Boston looks like, you know, not to mention, you know, Greater Tropical Asia. The effects would be enormous, civilization challenging. We can't allow it to happen. So it's at least preliminary good news that I think that we're beginning to take a tiny bit of the pressure off. You know, the rise in the price of gas is not going to solve this problem. If anything is going to solve it, I'll describe a little later what it might be. But at least we've begun to slow down the ocean liner or the oil tanker in this case, which is a necessary first step to turning it around at some point, which is the major reason or one of the two reasons that I'm not unhappy to see what's happening, what's changing quickly in America. The other reason is less obvious, but just as interesting. And it was really the subtext of this fairly recent book of mine called Deep Economy. In the kind of cult of economic growth that we've built in this society, and if you think, I mean, it is our default assumption that more is better. And if you have any doubt, you know, turn on NPR tomorrow night, and they broadcast Marketplace here, yes, on the public radio station. I mean, listen to it, you know. The stock market goes up, they play happy music. You know, the stock market goes down, they play a dirge. I mean, we're absolutely Pavlovian in our more is better idea. You know, the assumption that's undergirded that at some level, or that must have, is that more would produce better lives for people. But in the last few years, that assumption has begun to fall under all kinds of scrutiny. We didn't really used to ask it, okay? We didn't used to ask, academics didn't ask, is such and such making your life happier, okay? Because it seemed too soft and ephemeral a question, better left for church, you know? We accepted instead just the kind of economist's proxy for this, the idea of utility, that you could basically tell what made somebody happy by what they bought, okay? And operate on the assumption that if we did more, that would be better. But about 10 years ago, 10, 15 years ago, people from all kinds of disciplines began trying to look a little more closely at this, including economists. And Daniel Kahneman, who won at Princeton, who won the Nobel for Economics 5-6 years ago now, was one of the most important of these people to study. One of the things they first wanted to figure out was whether you could ask people that question, are you happy with your life, and get an answer that made any sense. Okay. Being economists, they researched it in a variety of dismal ways. One of the first studies that Kahneman quotes involves interrupting people every 10 seconds while they underwent colonoscopies to ask them how they were feeling, you know. Now, how are you feeling, you know? But over time, with a wide array of evidence from a number of disciplines, people got to the point where they believed that, in fact, subjective well-being was a robust phenomenon, that if you said you were happy, it correlated to things that we could measure in your brain chemistry, to how other people perceived you, on and on and on. Once you'd made that assumption, then you can start looking at this data that we had around that was quite interesting. For instance, every year since the end of World War II, one of the big national polling firms has asked Americans, are you happy with your life? And the number of Americans who say, yes, I'm very happy with my life, peaks in 1956 and goes slowly but steadily downhill ever since. A quarter of Americans will say, I'm very happy with my life right now. Very odd, because in that intervening 50 years, our material standard of living trebled on average. We have far bigger houses, obviously. We take far more exotic vacations. We can get food from everywhere. We have appliances no one had ever thought of. We can, you know, download any vaguely musical sound emitted anywhere on Earth to our devices, you know, on and on. And yet it hasn't left us in a transport of ecstasy, and the question is why? And the answer, when you look at the data, is fairly clear. Americans feel an enormous loss of connection and loss of community. Okay? And how could it be otherwise? As I said before, our basic goal for 50 years has been to build bigger houses farther apart from each other. That's come at an ecological cost. You have to heat and light and cool and then drive between all these things. But it's also come at an enormous social cost. The odds that you would run into anybody else in the course of a day just begin to go arithmetically down, okay? And it's precisely what's happened. The average American eats meals with friends, family, neighbors half as often as they did 50 years ago. The average American has half as many close friends as 50 years ago. That's a very large change for an evolved social primate to undergo in short order, you know? And there aren't enough iPods on Earth to make up for the sort of internalized grief that comes with that kind of loss. And of course, one of the problems is that as we do it, as we go through that kind of change, we lose many of the skills that we need that allow us to be in community. You know, the skills that human beings have built up over eons that really mark who we are as a species, we lose track of quite quickly. You know, we're not very good, for the most part, at community anymore. I was telling people the other day that there was a story in the New York Times about a year ago, at the height of the housing boom, before it had collapsed into a, you know, pile of worthless mortgage paper. There's a story in the Times where the reporter, and it was in the real estate section, and he asked the interesting question, what is in those houses the size of junior high schools that keep appearing everywhere? And the answer was, and this was true of all kinds of upscale starter housing, starter castles, you know, all over America, the answer was that many of them were coming with dual master bedrooms, okay? The husband snores, the wife pulls off the blankets, the American answer is, let's add 800 square feet to this house, okay? Which is obviously has ecological implications, you know, it takes all that much more energy to deal with it. It's obviously kind of sad if you know the rest of the world and know that in much of planet Earth, if you happen to have a bed in your house, there are three or four people sleeping in it and nobody is worrying about who's snoring or anything. But it's mostly just sad because it sort of illustrates, you know, we'd become the richest people in the richest nation on Earth, so alienated from each other that we were kind of hunkered down in our caves, staring out across the hall at our mates, you know? I mean, a very strange fate for that kind of wealth. Which is why I think that it's very nice to see, very nice to consider the possibilities, though in the moment it's a little rugged, of what we're going through at the moment. Basically, what happened was that cheap fossil fuel allowed us to become the first people in the history of the world who had no need of our neighbors for anything. Okay? None. You could, you know, everybody on your block could keel over tomorrow and you might be sad. Although in most of America, three quarters of Americans don't know their next door neighbors, so the sadness might be somewhat muted, you know. But you wouldn't be put out. It wouldn't interfere with getting your dinner or, you know, any of the other things that it would have done for almost every other human being almost always through history. And we've celebrated this hyper-individualism, this incredible independence as a great gift, But in fact, it's been a kind of quiet curse, robbing our lives of much of what is real. We've been insulated from much of what we're actually evolved for by this buffer of cheap energy that we've had. And so it's quite fun, I think, to imagine the world beginning to swing in a different direction, and in fact, to see it happening. I just stopped on the way over here. We stopped to say a few words at a party to celebrate the Brookwood Community Farm, yes, CSA nearby here, and they had all their sorts of their customers there and things. And it was a very good reminder of what's going on in our most basic commodity in terms of food. For the last 4 or 5 years, the fastest growing part of the food economy has been not Walmart, not Costco. It's been local farmers markets. Sales have been growing 15% or more a year. And partly it's because people want fresh local food and all of that. That's sort of the thing that gets you in the door, you know, or not in the door, in the parking lot, whatever it is that they're holding it. Thank you. But the real draw, I think, turns out to be less the food than the experience. A couple of years ago, a pair of sociologists followed shoppers, first around the supermarket and then around the farmer's market. You all have been to the supermarket. You know just how it works. You walk in, you fall into a light fluorescent trance, you visit the stations of the cross around the edges of the supermarket, you emerge with the same basket of items you had the week before. When they followed shoppers around the farmer's market, they had, on average, 10 times more conversations per visit. In order of magnitude, more conversations, more community, more neurons sort of being connected, more community starting to build. And that's only going to accelerate in the sort of post-cheap oil age. You know, at the moment, the average bite of food that we eat has traveled 2,000 miles to reach our lips. That's craziness. We think of it as normal, but if you really think about it, it's as if you phoned Denver every noontime and ordered takeout, you know, and the guy from the Domino's started driving, you know, from Colorado to reach you. It means that your food arrives marinated in crude oil on your plate, all right? We're going to see a lot more of that localness if we move into a more rational world of energy. And you can do the same thing with a lot of other commodities, too. You know, energy itself. We're used to the idea that it should come from some centralized, faraway location like food, you know, except this time instead of Archer Daniels Midland, it's Exxon or Peabody Coal or whoever, our BTU brokers, you know. But it doesn't need to be that way. My rooftop in Vermont is covered with solar panels, okay? They're tied into the grid. On a day like today, I'm a utility. I'm firing lots of power down the grid. My neighbor is, you know, cooling his beer preparatory to the Celtics game from the sunlight that is falling on my shingles. And if you start thinking about a system built out like that with millions of nodes all along the way, you end up with a system that looks a lot nicer than the one we've got now, partly because you can put more benign technologies more easily to work if you don't have to rely on some huge centralized power plant, and partly because you've built a system that's less vulnerable than the one we've got at the moment. You've got to be quite the optimist to think that the system we've got now really works very far into the future. I mean, you know, how to say it? Vermont, where I live, has lost a higher percentage of its population in the war in Iraq than any state in the Union. We're incredibly tired of going to funerals, but we're obviously going to be going to funerals as long as the most important part of our economy depends on, you know, it has to be sucked on a straw 5,000 miles long from beneath somebody else's territory who we have no idea how to, as we can now see, how to effectively manipulate their politics, even if that was a moral idea in the first place. So the idea of kind of community power looks a lot more interesting and a lot better. And, you know, you can do the same argument with almost anything you want, even with very ephemeral, non-carbon-intensive commodities, you know. I think they're, for other reasons, going to go the same direction. Think about music, okay? Until very recently, it worked the same way. There were a few centralized brokers, Sony, Warner, they sent you music in a hard-to-open plastic container, you know, that was what music was. Well, that business is going bust, and going bust in a hurry. People are figuring out how to, depending on how you look at it, either steal or share that music with each other, okay? But the exciting part is that the fast-growing part of the music industry is local live performance and festivals. And they're growing very fast because people want to consume things in the company of each other, you know, and that's half the experience. Sort of like, I mean, here we all are here tonight, you know. I have no doubt that each of you at home in front of the TV could actually find someone more interesting than me to listen to, you know. Maybe not on C-SPAN, but someplace, you know. But you wouldn't all be listening to the same thing, and you wouldn't be doing it in community, and it wouldn't therefore become kind of the subtext for conversation as the week went on, you know. It's a very different experience and a very much more powerful one in many ways. So in certain senses, most senses, I'm a great localist and communityist, and that's why it's so neat to be in a community that obviously works better than most and where people have made real efforts over time for that to happen. However, and I will end here, there are conversations that we need to have as a globe, and we need to have them much more globally than we ever have before, and we've got to figure that how to do that out fast. So while all my, and the most important of those conversations is about climate change. They do not call it global warming for nothing, okay? It can't be solved one house at a time, one light bulb at a time. It's coming apart much too fast for that. If it's going to be solved, it's going to be done at a national and international level, and we have to figure out how to make that happen because it isn't happening now. You remember that number that I told you was the most important number in the world? It's easy to see on my chest if you've forgotten. Okay. Tomorrow, you can log on. Launches tomorrow. Our spanking expensive new website called 350.org. Okay. I've spent the last couple of years trying to learn how to be an activist. It's not something I'm good at. I'm a writer. Writers like to stay at home and write. We're essentially antisocial and, you know, bad company and all of that. But I've been trying. I told the story earlier today at the Bikes Not Bombs thing of how it sort of came to happen that we, 2 years ago, 2 summers ago, just was feeling like nothing was going on. We weren't making any steps. You know, everybody had seen Al Gore's movie. Hurricane Katrina had come through. Still nothing happening. No movement around this. And wanting to do something but not knowing what to do. I'm a writer, you know. So, and I said, I called up a few of my writer friends up in Vermont and said, we've got to do something. Let's go to Burlington and we'll sit in on the steps of the federal building and we'll get arrested and there'll be a little story in the paper and at least we will have done something. They were all as clueless as I, oh, that's a very good idea. Sounds excellent to me, you know. And so someone called up to the police and said, actually, what would happen were we to do this? And the police said, well, nothing actually will happen. We'll come visit you. You know, you stay there as long as you want, you know. So we had to quickly recalibrate, and we organized very quickly in the course of about 2 weeks. I just started sending emails to everybody I knew. And we sort of had a pilgrimage, and we walked for 5 days to Burlington. We'd sleep in fields at night. We left from Robert Frost's old summer writing cabin up in the Green Mountains because we liked that most cliched of all high school English class poems about the road not taken. It seemed quite appropriate, you know. And so off we went, and we marched, and it was great. By the time we got to Burlington, there's 1,000 people marching, which in Vermont is a, you know, ungodly horde, more people than anyone had ever seen in one place at one time almost forever, you know. And all our politicians came, and they all, even the conservative Republicans, signed on to this pledge that we demanded of them, that they would work to cut carbon emissions 80% by 2050, which at the time was a very outlandish claim, you know. The woman who was running for Congress on the Republican ticket, she'd said 2 months before what they always say, oh, more research needs to be done. I don't know. Well, the more research that needed to be done, was how many people would walk across Vermont. You know, that's all it took. And 1,000 was enough. She signed the thing, all right? And that was very good for me to see, because I'd let myself get more cynical than I should have about our political system, you know? And it was really good to be able to show that to the kids that I was working with. And the only bad part was to open the paper the next morning and see a story saying this 1,000 people might have been the largest demonstration about climate change that had ever taken place in the U.S. Okay? So we said, can we do this on a larger scale? And so we started January last year, January 07, we launched this website, stepitup07.org, and asked people, started sending out emails, will you organize a demonstration like this on April 14th of 07 to make this same 80% by 2050 demand? We thought we might get 100 demonstrations around the country, you know? That would have been, we would have been incredibly happy. Excuse me. Instead, people everywhere, including lots of people in Boston and around Massachusetts, responded unbelievably well. And we had 3 months later, with no money and no organization, we had 1,400 demonstrations in all 50 states, you know? And many of them incredibly beautiful and very successful. The week after those demonstrations, both Hillary and Barack announced that, what do you know, the centerpiece of their energy and environment platform was going to be 80% reductions in carbon emissions by 2050. You know, that it worked the way it was supposed to work. Okay? Now there's enough people kind of doing this work in this country, or beginning to. Al Gore is going to use many tens of millions of dollars to run this WE campaign that you've begun to hear on the radio and things. And there's a group called OneSky.org that we've sort of helped form that's going to do a lot of lobbying. This stuff's beginning to happen, you know, in this country. But not anywhere near enough is happening around the world. And so our small crew has taken its goal, and we really need your help with this, for the next 18 months until the big international meeting in Copenhagen in December of 09 that's going to draw up the next great international treaty on carbon. Our job that we've taken on is simply to take this number 350 and spread it everywhere around the world, so that if people know nothing else about climate, they have some sense that this represents safety, you know? On the theory that, sort of like the way we were able to work those numbers last year in this country, that if we're able to establish this as the sort of psychological harbinger of success or failure, you know, that it'll move those negotiations someplace in the right direction, that it'll nudge them much further than the very lukewarm and tepid agreement they're aimed for now, you know, the product of endless brokering among special interests, and essentially no input at all by anybody, just normal people around the world. So we've undertaken this kind of, what you might almost call, though I shudder to do so, a sort of international branding campaign, you know, to take this number and make it the most well-known number on Earth, as well-known as, you know, what the right body temperature is, or how long a soccer field is, or, you know, all the sort of other few numbers that everybody knows. The one very good thing about a number, it's kind of arcane and abstract, right? 350 parts per million. On the other hand, Arabic numerals translate into every language on Earth, okay? Unlike anything else. I mean, if you say anything else you say doesn't, I mean, Coke a few years ago had a, remember they ran a big campaign called Coke Adds Life? Do you remember that? They tried to run it around the world. They had to discontinue it across much of sub-Saharan Africa because it apparently, the billboards all said, Coke brings your ancestors back from the dead, you know. I mean, there are inherent problems with trying to do that kind of... So 350 is good in that way, you know. It allows you to make those kind of changes. We don't have any money. What we do have is the internet, which is a tool that didn't exist until, in any real terms, until 4 or 5 years ago for this kind of work, that now reaches, through its kind of attendant technologies, mobile phones and things, pretty much everybody on Earth. You have to be very far. I mean, I've been in the most remote Tibetan villages, Bangladeshi villages, things like that. Somebody there has a cell phone, and they serve as the kind of communications link to the outside world, and you can text things in, and it works. You know. And this is what the internet, it turns out, without knowing it, was invented for. Not to trade dirty pictures, not to, you know, as in my case, you know, continually hit the refresh button to see how the Red Sox are doing, not any of those things, to take this one unbelievably important number and spread it everywhere around the world. But you can only do that if you can summon all the kinds of creativity that a group like this and all the contacts that a group like this would have. Because you need things that catch people's attention everywhere. When we did this Step It Up thing last year, everybody said, oh, you should have a march on Washington. That's how this is done. We said, no, we're not going to have a march on Washington. A, it's ridiculous to tell people to drive across America to stop global warming. And B, people in their own communities will know how to get this message across. And as they do it, we'll be able to take all those images and make them add up to more than the sum of their parts. And that's what happened. That afternoon on April 14th, we'd rented out a hall in Washington, okay, and brought all the bigwigs in that we could find to kind of watch the returns. And people were uploading photographs from all over America, and it was it was so moving that we could hardly even bring ourselves to get the whole, you know, thing organized. And we're just standing there watching slack-jawed because one beautiful image after another appearing, you know, hundreds of people in tricorn hats out on Lexington Green, you know, or down in Key West, Florida, all these underwater, dozens of people in scuba gear down off the coral reefs, which are, you know, completely toast in another 20, 30 years if the temperature keeps warming, doing this underwater demonstration, big fish swimming around, I mean, unbelievable. Jacksonville, Florida, they got a crane, they winched a yacht 20 feet up in the air. They said, you know, look, when Greenland slides into the ocean, there the ocean will be. You know, and everybody, oh, okay, now it starts to make sense, you know. New York City, we had thousands of people in blue shirts, everybody holding hands, human tide line. New Yorkers understand real estate. We were showing where the water was going to be in the most expensive real estate in the world, you know. On and on and on and on all over the country. The point I'm trying to make is that this was like the sort of new economy I'm describing, extremely local in its manifestation. Okay. And yet at the same time, we were able to take it and make it national anyway, and with real impact. You know? Now we got to try and do the same trick on a global scale. So we need you to go to that website tomorrow. Well, first you got to go look at this beautiful animation that we made. One of the amazing things about the internet is it's relatively cheap, you know. I mean, this is a good website. It's going to be working in 14 languages, which is something no one's ever really tried before. But, you know, ExxonMobil made $40 billion last year, right? I mean, they made more money than any company in the history of money, right? On the other hand, give ExxonMobil $100,000 to spend, well, $50,000 in this case, to spend on a website, and give my crew of 22-year-olds $50,000 to spend on a website, and ours will be a lot better than their. It'd give them $10 million to spend on their website, and our one is still going to be better and more. Well, we need now you to get us on that site the contact information of everybody you know around the world who would be at all interested in this. And people in the farthest flung parts of the world very much hunger once more to feel like some sense of common purpose, especially to feel like America might actually be getting back in the international game in some way after 8 years of completely absenting itself from the slightest interest in the opinion of anyone else on the planet about anything, you know. We also need you to think about creative ways to make this number real. What do I mean? The word of this has been leaking out, and so in the last little while. So every day we keep getting reports of interesting things going on. 350 bicyclists circling the State House in Salt Lake City over and over and over again. Big front page stories in the paper and on the radio and stuff. partly showing that they needed more bike paths in Salt Lake City, and partly taking this number and beginning to get it out, you know. Terry and other ministers this week in Massachusetts committed to having 350 churches around the Bay State each ring their bells 350 times someday between now and the end of the year. Well, there's not a radio station in Massachusetts that'll be able to resist coming and covering that. You know, what an amazing, interesting sound. It's something that will never have happened before. All the neighbors will be curious, you know, why is the bell keep ringing? Some of them will be annoyed, you know, but that's all right. The point will get out. It will be made. This number will start to enter into the kind of bloodstream of the planet. I opened the email yesterday and there was a photograph that some guy in a little village in the Cameroon took with the camera on his mobile phone, showing he and his, I don't know how they heard about this, but they were planting 350 trees on the edge of their village, okay, with a little sign about 350. This is the most important number in the world, in whatever language you speak in the Cameroon. I don't even know. We can take those images and we can begin to magnify them around the world. The great Mexican poet, Homero Arregis, wrote a wonderful long essay in last Sunday's edition of La Reforma, the best, the most important newspaper in Mexico City, about 350, you know. There's big pieces this Sunday in the South African newspapers, you know. Next week, people have decided that they're taking out these full-page ads in the Financial Times and the International Herald Tribune. You know, stuff just beginning to kind of happen, you know. You get summoned to Sweden in a couple of weeks for this. King Gustav, whoever he is very excited by the concept of 350, and he's having his friend Kofi Annan, the former Secretary General of the UN, and me come over and talk about it. My carbon footprint is growing by the minute, you know, as do this. But that echo chamber is just starting to happen. But if you guys... I mean, the whole only way that this is possible is if there's some kind of viral thing gets going. If all of you jump into it and lend your oar to it. Look, I wish I could tell you that were you to do this, it was necessarily all going to work out. And I can't tell you that. I don't know whether, I mean, the vested interests that we're up against are extraordinarily strong, and the inertia that we're up against is extraordinarily strong, and the physical momentum now underway of these changes, the chemistry and physics situation, is pretty tough, okay? Things are happening pretty fast. It's pretty clear that, at the very least, the very best, this is our last real chance, this international set of negotiations. I don't know if it's all going to work out. I mean, it's not all going to work out. I don't even know if it's going to stop short of real... I mean, the name of the book that I wrote about all this 20 years ago was The End of Nature. Now, I'm not, you know, super cheerful all the time about everything. But I feel more optimistic today than I have any time in a sense in the last 20 years. The outpouring of people who are willing to get involved, given the opportunity, as with Step It Up, and now with this, is really beautiful. And, of course, you can see it across all parts of our other political spectrum, too, you know. 1.5 million people gave money to Barack Obama in the last few months because they had a chance to. You know, their technology existed that allowed them to make their feelings suddenly real in some substantial way, you know. And in the same sense, in a little way, with this. We can see what's coming. We can see that we're at the edge of the end of the era of fossil fuel. And the question is just, you know, what kind of people we are in the face of that. Whether we're the kind of people who will try to keep normal life going a few more years because it's the easiest thing to do and we're used to it and we can't be bothered to do otherwise, and we've got a lot of other things to worry about, and, you know, we're short of money, whatever. Or whether we're the kind of people who say, yes, actually, this is one of those few odd, pivotal moments in human history, and we damn well better step up to the plate and figure out how to make as much difference as we can together in as short a period as we can. And if we do, if we're able to get real global agreement, then we have a shot. The window is still open. It's closing, and it's not particularly wide open, but we've got a shot, you know? I'm eager to have questions, but the one question that I have no intention of answering is one that people ask me often, which is, are you optimistic or pessimistic about all this? And I think at a certain level, I just gave up many years ago being either one. I just know that the stakes are such that it's important that we work as hard as we can right now and see what on earth happens on the other side. Thank you all.
Sure.
Okay. I'll just say one thing. Thank you.
All right. Thank you all very much.
We have. I wanted to mention that tonight one of our co-sponsors is our great local independent bookstore, Rhythm and Muse. And Dave from Rhythm and Muse is here. And he's open for business if you want to buy some of the books that Bill has written. He also brought a collection of other books related to the climate, environmental issues, and other topics. And Bill is willing to sign books after this program. So we'll have 25 minutes of questions, discussion, and then an informal book signing. Ask people to pay for their books, and then if they could come, just line up on this aisle, come down here to sign them. But Bill has agreed to field his own questions. If you could speak loudly, we don't have a portable mic tonight, so speak loudly for others.
Yeah, absolutely. The is this the
family?
The that's too loud. The one of the first things to know about climate change is the unbelievable unfairness that accompanies it. You know, it's almost a perfect correlation between the people who do the least to contribute to it getting hit the hardest quickest, all right? I mean, all the other ways that we've figured out over the years, colonialism, imperial, to sort of make miserable the lives of people in other parts of the world, don't really come close to destroying the basic fabric of their physical life on which billions of people depend for their daily bread, okay? I mean, you don't even need to list all the reasons, all the places and all. I mean, they're all sort of obvious. But, you know, last month the Brazilian army was setting up thousands of field hospitals across Brazil because they had a dengue outbreak so severe that the average emergency room was getting 70 cases an hour. Okay? Dengue is a mosquito-borne illness that's multiplying 100, 200, 300% annually in many regions now because warmer temperatures are allowing the spread of Aedes aegypti, the mosquito that spreads it. On and on and on, and always in places where people aren't contributing much to the problem. Yeah, we've got to adapt, you know, in as many ways as we can. But the first thing we have to do is make sure that, you know, try to prevent, there's no way to adapt to the worst set of changes that we may cause, okay? If we raise the level of the ocean 25 or 30 feet, there's not enough money on Earth to even begin to adapt to that, you know? You can't build seawalls fast enough. You can't, I mean, there's just no way. And so job one is to make sure that the worst tipping points don't happen. And job two is to, exactly right, to help people in all kinds of places cope with the problems that were, cope not only with the problems that were causing them, but also, of course, cope with the fact that if we make a serious international agreement, all the poor countries of the world are going to have to find something other than cheap coal on which to base their climb out of poverty, right? They're not going to be able to do what we did to get dignified level of consumption. They're going to have, and they're not going to be able to do that unless we provide them with some of the means to do it, unless we pay for some of the spread between what it costs to build a coal-fired power plant in China and a windmill in China, all right? That's partly on us because we've filled up the atmosphere, which means they can't. So, yeah, absolutely. It's what makes it, the thing that makes this problem so intractably hard that worries me the most is precisely the unequal place from which the world begins trying to address it. You know, where the average American uses more energy between the stroke of midnight on New Year's Eve and dinner on January 2nd than the average sub-Saharan African uses in the course of a year, okay? I mean, those gulfs are so enormous that the ability to reach some is going to be very hard. And it's one of the big reasons why, you know, when you go to that website tomorrow, you'll find it working in 14 languages and how important it is to be able to mobilize people in the poorest parts of the world to understand and to be able to, frankly, put some pressure on the rest of us in the rich parts of the world to do the right thing. It's got to be working as a whole. Very good question.
Any question?
You're working very hard, Chuck.
Switch off.
The question was about voluntary simplicity. Yeah, the Center for New American Dream is one of those places that everybody should visit once in a while on the web. It's a wonderful outfit. One of my dearest old friends, Betsy Taylor, founded it, and they do amazing work in trying to help people understand that there are other possibilities for, you know, how we might live our lives. Because the hardest part, you know, of imagining a different world is just the imagining. You know, when you see, if you're, you know, 18 years old and you've seen whatever it is, 478,000 television commercials or something from the beginning of your childhood till your current, well, the odds that you're going to just sort of spontaneously think of some other way that there might be is fairly low. So, I mean, it's very important. And these questions of voluntary simplicity are very important, but they're only important if they serve as a kind of calisthenics for doing the getting, you know, nerving yourself up to then get involved politically in ways that count, okay? Because it doesn't really, you can't make the math work one light bulb at a time. If we had 100 years, you could. Okay, and we teach the next generation to be a little more responsible and a little more responsible after that. And we, okay, that would, but that's not the situation that we're in. The physics and chemistry of the situation that we're in, over the limit, way too high, Arctic melting, are that we get change politically or we don't get it at all. The other stuff becomes left to itself, a kind of way to feel better than one should about one's actions. Our motto, I was telling people at dinner, our kind of unofficial motto at Step It Up became, screw in the new light bulb, but then screw in the new senator, you know? And the second, a good deal more important than the first. It's only at that, and it's the oddest thing, because we tend to think of screwing in the new light bulb, or whatever sort of set of things one's doing in one's own life, there, as the practical real world actions, and organizing 350 bicyclists to go or ringing your church bell 350 times, we tend to think of that as the symbolic action that we would take. Okay, but in fact, they're really almost the opposite. It's a beautiful symbolic gesture to put in the right light bulb or to thing in your home. And I've done it all. I have a plaque on my house because it got a prize for being the most energy efficient house in Vermont one year, you know, whatever. But the practical thing I do is not that. The practical thing I do is try to build, in many of you the same way, the political weight necessary to make real change. And that's been a very hard thing for me to get my head around, but for some reason the people who pick it up immediately tend to be the young people that I work with, college students and things. Partly because they're going to have to live with whatever we do for 60 or 70 more years, okay? And so they have very much less patience for any kind of cosmetic response at all. And they want actually to reduce the amount of carbon in the atmosphere. It's a very curious thing.
In 2004, in the presidential election, in all of the debates, there was about 3 minutes on the entire environment, and global warming, and all other issues of the environment. Do you hold any hope that maybe in this upcoming election there will be a serious debate on the environment, especially seeing as media frames the questions and frames the debates, and especially seeing that both candidates still cling to such dinosaur notions like nuclear power as a solution to our carbon crisis, or the notion of clean coal. There's an oxymoron. And how can we make this debate really truly happen? If you need a global Manhattan-like project for climate rescue.
Yeah. Well, as to the sort of first specific question, my guess is that climate change is not going to be at the forefront of our presidential debate this fall. I think mostly because, though it's not really true, in sort of media terms, both of the candidates are on the side of doing something about climate change. Okay, and since there's not a wide difference, but there is actually a wide... Obama's very good on this stuff. Not perfect, as you point out, but very good. And getting better, all right? And McCain, who I've spent time with and written about, has, you know, had a good policy for a Republican in 2002, but it's now no longer anywhere near, you know, state-of-the-art anything, you know. And the people that he would put in to enforce it would be bad. And the choice on those terms is very clear. But I don't think it's going to become a big debate, because I think we're going to focus on the things about which they're clearly very different, you know, the war in Iraq or more tax cuts or whatever else. But in the broader sense, the only way to get these guys anywhere around the world to take this seriously, to debate it, to put it near the front, is to build that kind of movement. You know, we were able to do that with Step It Up, and we actually, I mean, I was almost sorry at how quickly both Clinton and Obama said, yep, and Edwards too, we'll sign on, you know. It was almost too easy because they signed on to our very tough maximal demand right away, you know. And we probably could have had another 6 months out of organizing out of it if they hadn't, and it might have been salutary in that way. But it's allowed us to go on and try to do the same thing around the world. Movements, you know, it's so tempting to think that change would happen simply because it made sense or something like that. But it doesn't. It happens when enough people get together to ask that it happen in one way or another. And I don't know quite what those ways are all going to be and if they're going to end up involved. I'll tell you this story. I went to jail in the only first civil disobedience protest of any kind that there was about climate change in this country about 7 years ago, maybe eight. And I only went because this friend of mine, who some of you have doubtless heard of, a wonderful woman in New Hampshire named Granny D, this woman who walked across the country at the age of 90 to demand change in campaign finance. She called me up and said, we're going down to Washington, we're going to get arrested, you should come. You know, she, you know, I'm well-raised, so at this point she was 93, you know, well, I'm not going to say, no, sorry, I can't, I'm busy, you know. I went, and we were, two of us were holding a sign, and it said, stop global warming, stop campaign contributions from global warmers. And they don't like you to do such a thing in the Capitol Rotunda, so they let us, they handcuffed the two of us together, which was quite funny, because she's like 4'2" or something, you know. And she looked up at me as we were in lunch. And she said, I'm 93. I've never been arrested before. I should have started long ago, she said. I have no idea if that's what this movement's going to look like or need to look like or whatever. But I do know it's going to need to be as morally urgent and as serious and as passionate and as willing to sacrifice as civil rights movement was a generation ago. And if it isn't, then we're not going to get the answers that we need, the change that we need, because the force that we're fighting is too strong, okay? Fossil fuel is the center of our economy. Hence, it means that it comes with zillions of special interests deeply embedded in it who don't want change. And getting that change will require everybody with enough sense of what does have to happen doing what they can in a public and loud and hopefully beautiful way to make it happen. And all Step It Up was and all 350.org is an attempt to provide a forum for that to happen. Okay? But it clearly doesn't happen with me, or I mean, it clearly only happens if all of you decide that you're going to participate here in Jamaica Plain doing some interesting demonstration, and probably more than one, and by connecting to people all around the world to get, you know, everybody, I mean, if, you know, all that stuff is true about, like, 6 degrees of separation and stuff. I mean, if we went carefully through this room, we'd connect into, you know, with one or two hops into all 187 nations or whatever on Earth. You know, we'd be able to connect just a couple hundreds of rooms, all it would take, you know. So, you know, job one is to watch Kevin Garnett and Paul Pierce, you know, do their thing. But tomorrow, to do this, because it actually is important. Do we have time for one more? I don't know. That's as good a place to end as any. Let's do one more. We got a little tax credit from the state of Vermont. They cost more. You can't yet make a really strong economic case for their payback, okay? On the other hand, we have, you know, it's sort of like paying your electric bill for the next 20 years in advance, you know? And my guess is that electric bills are going to go up and up and up for 20 years. So, in economic terms, I'm willing to. But it's also true that there's nothing else that we buy where we say, what's the payback time on my flat screen TV, you know, or whatever. It's just like, I want it, I bought it. It's like the same cost as getting cable TV every month, okay, or something like that, to pay it off. Well, the best decision I ever made in my life, quite apart from the fact that it allowed me to buy solar panels, was to get rid of the TV 20 years ago anyway, you know. But, you know, those are the kind of choices that those of us who are in some position to make them need to begin to make, partly so that it'll help bring down the cost of those things. But again, the most important thing to do is not to do it on your own roof, but to take the time to build the. Here's a quiz. What's the country on the earth with the most solar panels, highest percentage of solar power? Germany. Have people here been to Germany? Germany's like this gloomy Wagnerian place. It's like mists, you know. It's hardly ever sunny, you know. They have very little sun, much worse than Vermont for sun. But they have this resource that we could develop called political will, you know, endlessly renewable. And we, you know, if we develop it, we could have the same kind of government commitment that would allow everyone here to begin doing that, and it would very quickly bring the cost of these things down to the point where they're obvious to do. There are people like Dick who are figuring out interesting ways to finance them and allow them to happen. All that needs to go on. But the central question is always going to be about whether this is a choice that we want to make, not as individuals, but as a society, okay, as a community. And this is a good place to end because it sort of underlines the point I was trying to make. It's the many, many years of thinking about everything in very individual terms that's increasingly got us in the place where we are. You know, this kind of hyper-individualism that accompanied fossil fuel. And the great excitement and the great challenge and the great difficulty is to learn once again to think of things in community terms, in political terms. That's all politics is people in the community figuring out how they're going to organize their lives together. And if we're willing to do that work, you know, that work, the kind of numbers represented in this room are enough to change the politics of small places anyway, you know. We were today over at the park where we're having this event this afternoon, the plaque on the wall of the 100 people who managed to keep them from building a highway through the middle of, well, you know, they're building a freaking highway through the middle of the earth right now. I mean, that's what global warming is, you know, the complete disintegration of all the human and natural communities around us. And, you know, if we can figure out ways to get people in all those places to stand up, even in those relatively small numbers, it'll be enough to turn the tide on this. I have no idea if we can, but that's what we're trying to do. So thank you all so much for helping out.
Thanks again, Bill. Thank you all for coming. Please support your local independent bookstore, Rhythm and Muse. Bill is willing, graciously agreed to sign books if people would like to purchase a book and have him sign it. Think about somebody you'd like to give a copy of Deep Economy to. And thanks for coming.
Indeed, indeed. Are you a baseball fan as well?
Of course. Not as quite as much as Carl.
Yeah. He's a terrific guy.
Thanks.
Thank you very much.
I enjoyed your talk.
Thank you very much. Tell me your name.
Finn Holtz.
Finn?
Yep.
F-I-N-N?
Yep.
Let me sign this for you.
First got just here.
Are you really?
A lot.
Well, the last two pieces in here, two of the last three are about cross-country skiing.